Tabor Pepper, welcome to the podcast, man.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Listen, if someone has just come across this video, maybe it's my title that brought them in or my crazy thumbnail. Why do you think they should stick around and listen to what you have to say?
Because I would like to think I'm rather insightful. I don't know. I've just had a lot of kind of crazy things happen in my career, whether it's football, among just many other stories. So I think it's one of those things where just hearing different people's perspective and how they might have persevered through different things, just how it shapes their mindset, I think is pretty interesting. So we shall see. I'll let them be the judge.
Well, I can't wait to get into some of these crazy stories, but I do have to start with this. I have a 49ers group chat, and when I told them I was interviewing you, they were all going crazy. They're like, oh, we love Tabor, blah, blah, blah. And but one of the questions that kept coming up, because I was like, hey, like, do you guys have any questions for him? Like, are you, you know, what are you interested in? And they all had the same question, like, how the hell does someone become a long snapper, and how do you get recruited as a long snapper? So I figured we'd start there.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting story. So growing up, I had always been the quarterback. Started playing like flag football in second grade, was school football, started in eighth grade. And then I think in like sixth grade, I was like, oh man, being a quarterback's a lot of pressure. So I kind of like stepped away from it then. It was just a lot for my sixth grade psyche. But then I was like playing receiver and like linebacker and stuff like that growing up. And it was fine. But in eighth grade, it was the first year of school ball. So like kind of all the community teams came together and it was like a pretty big team. And so the coach said, you know, whoever wants to be a long snapper, come over here. And I think there were like 10 or 12 kids and we were all like 10 yards apart. And, you know, we all started snapping. Everyone was like shotgun snapping it. But in sixth grade, my dad told me like, you're supposed to do it with two hands. And I never really like practiced before then. And so I was the only one doing it with two hands. And so the coach goes down the line and he's like, you're fired, you're fired, you're fired, Pepper, you're hired. And my mom signed me up for a camp, I think that fall. And it was kind of just history after that. I liked doing it. I liked learning about it. And then I was living in Oklahoma growing up. And then when I was going into 10th grade that summer, my family moved to Michigan. And I was actually going to quit playing football in 9th grade or like going into 10th grade if I stayed in Oklahoma. But because I was moving, I like knew I needed to make friends. And so in Oklahoma, tennis was a spring sport. Football's fall, obviously. But in Michigan, men's tennis at our high school was in the fall. And so I was like, well, I'll just go whichever sport has the bigger team just so I can meet some people before I go to school and stuff. So kept doing it then. And then, you know, the camps I was going to, they have like a ranking system. And so I was kind of moving up the ranks steadily. And my whole life, my dad played at University of Illinois. In 89 and 90. And so my whole life, I kind of just like grew up like, oh, I'm going to play college football. But when I got into 10th grade and started learning more about recruiting, I was like, wait a minute, how am I supposed to like play in college if I'm like third string wide receiver and like fourth string D end? And I'm like, I guess I'll be a long snapper. After that, I like really attacked it, like went to even more camps, just practiced all the time, had a bunch of people, you know, laughing at me saying like, oh, you're never gonna, you can't like go to college as a long snapper. And that I got lucky because right around that gap of like 2010 to like 2013, that's when a lot of schools started offering full rides for college snappers. And I was ranked like top 15, like my junior year, part of my senior year. And then going into my senior year, I got ranked in the top 5. And I was going to be a walk-on at University of Michigan. And then Michigan State was my first choice anyway. Just, I love their campus. When I went there for my first visit, I like fell in love with it. And like in my mind, when I was walking there, I was like, this is what I've always imagined like college looking like. So they were always my top pick, but they had a freshman long snapper come in my senior year of high school. And so they were set circumstances, crazy scenarios happened, and they kicked that kid off the team, and they had a long snapper emergency is the way that was described to my family. And so I went up and took another visit to MSU, and Coach D, you know, realized he had to offer me a scholarship if he wanted me to go there. And so, you know, he understood like it was a bad look if they just offered me another preferred walk on and I did like a lateral move. He was like, I understand to switch you. I gotta offer you a scholarship. And a week later, I was dressed in a full University of Michigan sweatsuit in my living room, getting ready to go to their spring game. And UPS knocked on my door, and it was a big green envelope. And, you know, the rest is kind of history.
You said you wanted to quit football. What was it, ninth grade? What? Why is that?
So what was crazy about living in Oklahoma was I started kindergarten and first grade in Illinois, and so they start at like normal years, and I can't remember exactly what it was, like six or something like that, or five for kindergarten or something. When we went to Oklahoma, typically the boys start a year later than the girls, and then if you know, they had a thing in between kindergarten and first grade called transitional one. And so if your family's like football obsessed, a lot of boys, like it's like 90% boys that are in that T1 class. Basically going through school, when I moved to Oklahoma, all the boys were like 2 years older than me. Luckily I was tall, so I wasn't too out of place. But man, when we started hitting those like middle school years, like puberty was real. Like I was looking around, I was like, how do you guys have beards already? And you know, I was like a little bit of a late bloomer, like not too late, but it was just exacerbated by the fact that all these guys were so much older than me. And then football is just way more serious in the South. And so, you know, they started their lifting programs like way earlier in Oklahoma than they did in Michigan, I came to learn. And so it was just one of those things where like, I mean, physically I was getting left behind. And I just enjoyed tennis more at that time. Because I also just didn't have my calling of long snapping yet. And I don't know if I ever would have had, well, I guess not to the degree of what it was in 10th grade, but I wouldn't have even had the opportunity to like really land that job had it not been for the move. So it was all crazy happenstance. I think about it all the time. Like I hated moving in the middle of 10th grade. Like it's the worst time to move a teenage kid. I mean, it's just crazy. I couldn't imagine what would have happened with my life.
Yeah, I moved at the beginning of seventh grade, and I thought that was bad. And I remember like the first day of seventh grade walking around my new middle school and being like, I know no one, like I don't know where I fit in, like you don't have your group, et cetera, et cetera. So I can only imagine like moving in 10th grade, like, yeah, that's tough. Malcolm Gladwell has this awesome book called Outliers, which I don't know if you've read, but and he, at the beginning of the book, he talks about, which maybe you might remember this better than I will, so I'm probably gonna butcher it, but he talks about how like hockey, like youth hockey, there's like cutoffs for age groups. And so depending on like what month you're born in, like you're either in the higher or in the lower age group, and how like basically by luck, if you're born in, and I forget if it's like January, February or March, months.
It was like those first 2 months, I think.
Yeah, then you get placed in a certain age group where, you know, you can perform better and ultimately it's better for your hockey career, and how like a lot of the hockey players, star hockey players now, were born in you know, those first 2 months. Yeah. So like I think about that, and I think about your story, and I'm like, isn't it kind of crazy, like when you think back in time, like how many things had to go right, how many things had to fall into place for you to end up where you are today?
I mean, honestly, like theoretically being on the hook for even a semester or a full year of college at U of M, even though I would have been in state, like that changes the trajectory. Like, I mean, I would have had to redshirt. Who knows what like the next year's like draft class would have looked like. There were just so many extenuating factors. I mean, I was super skinny when I went into Michigan State. I was like 185 my freshman year and played at like 205 my sophomore year. And like the coaches were on my ass about gaining weight. And that was like a big struggle on its own. Like, you know, a lot of people, they don't have the same sympathy. There's almost disdain for people who are trying to gain weight. And it's weird because like, I don't want to say I had an eating disorder, because I think naturally my body at that time, like, my limit was 210. I would weigh 205. The coaches would be on my ass. I'd get up to 210 and then I would just feel sick. Like, it had nothing to do with me feeling like, oh, I'm going to get fat or whatever. Like, we were lifting, like, college lifting programs are crazy. Like, you get huge. Like, there was no risk of me being, like, fat. So it wasn't like a aesthetics thing, but like, my body literally would not let me get past 210. I had to, like, show up in the weight room at like 6 a.m. With two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and I would eat those in front of the wait staff and then drink two chocolate milks. And like, but like, the rest of the day I would, like, feel normal hunger cues, and then when I would sit down with a plate at the cafeteria or whatever, I would take a bite and then my stomach would flip. Like, it was, and then at that point it had to have become like a mental hurdle that I couldn't have gotten over. It was just so weird. And so, like, you're talking about all those extenuating circumstances. Like, we had a sports psychologist that we used at Michigan State. And he got brought in back when Saban coached Michigan State, and he worked with the Eagles in Alabama at that time, and he traveled all around the country to a few different places. I don't think they had access to that specific sports psychologist at U of M, and this guy helped me. And, you know, he was also a psychiatrist, so he was able to prescribe me a medicine that, like, helped me eat a little bit more. And I gained like 35 pounds that off season. I was 235 by the time the season that next, my junior year, started. Cause then when I was like halfway through my sophomore season ended, I was still like around 210 in like February. I was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to play in the NFL now. Like, if I can't weigh at least 225, I don't have a shot in hell. And then I was coming to terms with that. I finally got to sit down with this doctor. They literally call him the wizard because he looks like Gandalf. It's crazy. But it was just so crazy. And yeah, I got prescribed that medicine, and it helped me eat a little bit more, and I gained 35 pounds. And I had coaches coming up to me, and they're like I had one coach. He literally like kind of like got next to me, not like quite in front of me. He's like, how big are you now? And I was like, 235. He was like, are you juicing? I was like, no, I'm actually eating now. And he's like, you need to tell someone if you are. And I'm like, I swear to God, I'm not. And it was just crazy. And everything kind of fell into place after that too. I actually had a shot, to go to the NFL after that.
You mentioned the Gandalf, the sports psychologist. What do you most remember from the things that he would teach? And the reason I ask is because, especially on this podcast, I like to dive into a lot of like the mental side of whatever sport you're playing. But I feel like that's such a huge component that certainly, you know, I can speak for myself as a fan. Like, we don't, you know, I don't notice that on the field. Like, I can't see what you're thinking. You know, I can't see inside your mind. But it's so big within sports. I mean, I played sports in high school, nowhere near the level of the NFL. But even at that level, it's like, all right, you know, you miss a couple shots here and there and your confidence starts to dwindle. And so I'm just curious, kind of why do you think he was so instrumental in your journey?
I mean, like, I'm not going to lie, like the medical intervention of like prescribing me a medicine like helped a lot. But in that session where we finally decided on like the course of action we were going to go through, like, he told me the story, and like, it's like kind of crass, but like, it's history. It's real. It happened. He was telling, like, he served in like whatever the later one was. I can't remember if it was Korea or Vietnam, but he served in one of those wars, and they literally had a technique when they had like Viet Cong like prisoners. They would always really take care of like the leader of whoever was captured. So they had all these like low level soldiers and stuff. Whoever was like the highest ranked guy, they had him in his own separate hut. They fed him, they took care of him, all this stuff. So what they would do that after a while. Then what the prisoners didn't know is that there were cameras in there. And so starting like about a month or two or a few weeks out, they would be like, hey, you guys, like, you know, we've taken care of you. You've done a great job of like keeping your guys in line since they've been, you know, in captivity, basically. We're going to get you some girls. We're going to get you some girls in here. Don't worry about it. But like, hey, like, we're doing you a solid, like, you got to perform. And they started like really getting in these guys' heads. And like, you got to perform, like you got to give them a good time too. Like, but we're going to bring you girls. Like, it's a big deal. Like, this doesn't happen often. Da, da, da. And they're just building it up, building it up, building it up. All that to say, they had those cameras in there because they had built it up in this prisoner's mind so much that then when the time came that they brought the girls, these guys couldn't perform. And they used that as blackmail. If you don't keep your guys in line, we're going to show them this video that you're less of a man or whatever. And so kind of what he was like telling me at that point was like, it's become such a big deal in my mind that I need to gain weight, that like, no wonder my stomach is flipping. And it was just the most frustrating thing because I wanted to eat. I was hungry. I had hunger cues. And it was just so weird in my mind. It affected me outside of like football environments too. Like if I went on a date with a girl and like we went out to sushi, I would order what I felt like I could eat. And then I'm sitting there and we're talking and I've noticed that like, and it's obviously so mental. Like I noticed I would only eat two pieces of my roll and I look across the table from me and the girl's like almost done with her full like roll. And I'm like, oh my God, like I know some girls are weird about it. I don't want to make her feel bad, but like, I also don't want to look like, what is this dude? Like, can't, I don't know, but I like built it in my mind. And so I would go to the bathroom and like try to relax and like go pee and like I would like rub my stomach to like make room or whatever. Like, but it just seems so backwards. And like, you know, anytime I'm like, oh, I'm trying to gain weight, people are like, huh, I'll help you find it. Like, I need to lose weight. Can you find it for me? And I'm like, it's just not, it's just, everything was just so backwards and people just don't understand. Like, kind of eating stuff is just like, everyone has their own struggles with it, whether it's a football player or whether it's someone who is overweight or a girl in middle school who thinks she's too fat and like isn't and like develops anorexia, like affects us all differently. So I definitely feel like, and on top of that, there's just the mental side of being a long snapper and a specialist, which is its own thing. And I was snapping well, it wasn't affecting my snapping, but like my coaches wanted me bigger. So it was just a whole thing and everybody had their comments. Yeah.
I guess it kind of also speaks to like the, speaking of girls, like the advice that I feel like people always give, like, let's say you have a friend that's like, you know, has been single for a while. And I feel like the advice that people usually give is like, hey man, just like, you know, don't think about it. Don't go and pursue it too heavily. Like it'll come like when the time's right, like when you're not looking for it, it will come to you. Like that's when, things kind of open up. And I feel like it's almost like a lesson in like just minimizing the amount of overthinking that you do and just stop thinking about it and just go do it and kind of, you know, live with the results afterwards.
Yeah. And I mean that like it's true, but like even that can be hard. Like just doing it, you know, it's like standing at the top of a high dive. It's like, what? Just jump off. And you know, it's like some of these things are scary, but because you've built it up so much, like it is hard to just do it. But I mean, yeah, like at the end of the day, depending on what it is, like you just have to, you know, as we learn and we grow, especially as athletes or whether you're in business or something, like all of these lessons have like contributed to like the successes of like the future and stuff. You know, you gotta make, whether it's mistakes or just learning like how your own brain works is such a big deal.
I wouldn't get to your experience at Michigan State, but I do want to ask, just staying on the topic of kind of the mental side of football, how much do you think football is mental versus physical?
I think it's pretty, well, my coach was a big quote guy and it made me like a big quote guy too. Coach D would always say mental is to physical as four is to one. And so I think like football is physical, like you have to be a physical person no matter what. And that some people have their own hurdles with that. But like, especially as you rise in the ranks, like the level of gameplay and the X's and O's that you have to like be aware of and like learn and ingrain so your body can just react instead of you thinking about it. You know, we had a, a Spartan handbook that we would go through every summer during training camp. And the one thing that always stuck out in my mind was like, it was like this four panel matrix, and it was like the, can't remember the official title, but it was like the different levels of competence. And it's like unconscious, incompetence, which basically meant like you're not even aware of how incompetent you are. And then there was conscious incompetence, where it's like now you're aware that you're like not good enough or not achieving like what you should be, whatever it is, whether even if it's like wrapping a gift. Like someone's like, hey, wrap this gift. If you don't know and you don't care, you're just going to fold it up and it's going to look like crap. Then it's like, oh, well, like maybe I could learn how to do it better. And you're like really aware of all the mistakes that you're making. It's like, oh, that looks crappy. I could have done that better. And then you have conscious competence, which is the next level. And that's like you really have to think about everything you're doing and you're able to achieve it because you've practiced it. But the ultimate goal is to get into that matrix of unconscious competence, where you don't have to think about it and it's just automatic. And like that's something that's always stuck with me, and like that is everything in life, whether it's a hobby, a job, even an emergency. Sometimes when we get into emergency situations, if you haven't even thought about something like that, you're gonna freeze. There's a certain amount of truth to it, but it is funny. Like I've seen people on social media who are like those like macho alpha male red pill guys. And they're like, I sit with my back, to the wall so I can see, you know, all the entry points and exit points. And I have a plan if something goes down. And it's like, okay, dude, chill out. Like chill out. But at the same time, it's like that guy probably would be ready. That guy would be more ready than someone who just doesn't care at all. Like it is funny because it's like chill, chill, chill. But if he has a plan, he has a plan. He at least knows where the exit signs are probably well enough to know where to take himself or his date if something does go down. But it's just, yeah, it's just one of those things that I think I've never heard it anywhere else. And I think that's why it stuck with me too. I've never seen anybody quite put it that way. I can't remember your exact question to be honest, but one thing I thought about, because I was just thinking about my whole journey in the NFL, after I graduated college, that first like season of the NFL, I did two mini camps with the Ravens, and then from basically the end of June till December, I didn't hear anything from a single team. And I got super down and depressed. Like I was living back at my parents' house. I had a room there, but like I was basically living in the basement. There was like a mattress down there. And so I basically like made my room our basement area. But I was like staying up to like 3 or 4 AM, sleeping till 1 to 2 PM. And like, I was still like working out and training and stuff, but it was just such a slog. And I'm like, wow, this is not turning out at all like I thought it would. And I remember it kind of came to a head when I had been doing that for a few weeks. And my mom was like, I'm actually worried about you. Like, you need to fix this. Like, at least start waking up at a normal time and going to sleep at a normal time. And at that time, I was out of town at my grandparents' house, and I saw someone that I went to high school with was teaching yoga at this yoga studio in town. And so I started going, and I like really liked it and threw myself at it. And through doing yoga, you know, the place I went to was like, it wasn't like woo woo, but like there was always almost like a lesson in each class, like this hot yoga vinyasa class. And that was the first time I heard about mindfulness. And so I pulled it up here in my off monitor, but one of the first books I read that like really, really helped me, and like, I think has like really formed like who I am. I've only read one book on mindfulness. But it's Mindfulness for Beginners. Jon Kabat-Zinn is the author, and it's a short book, but it literally does teach the basics of it. But you can just extrapolate so much from it. It's any of my friends who are like just struggling in life and are like, you know, brave enough to like share that with me, I just send them this book on Amazon and it's super fast and simple, and whether they read it or not, like, that's up to them. But I just think it's such a basic, easy to read book. I still have it on my bookshelf upstairs. I haven't touched it since, but I mean, it was pretty fundamental. And, you know, I've read like stoicism books and different stuff like that, but at the core, that's definitely the most like easy to understand and kind of where all those other ones like branch out from.
Dude, you should look into George Mumford. I don't know if you're familiar with him or his work, but he did a bunch of work with like the Phil Jackson Bulls, and then after with the Lakers, actually kind of followed Phil Jackson around, but did work with MJ, with Kobe, was really instrumental in their mindfulness journey. And I mean, I had him on the podcast, but he's written books. You can find, I'll maybe send you a couple links after this. He has a website, George Mumford, M-U-M-F-O-R-D.
Okay. I read Grover's book, Relentless.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that one and he worked with those guys too.
Yeah.
That one was good. I mean, that one's definitely for a specific type of people.
Right.
But there's definitely truths to it. That like dark place is a really interesting thing to kind of learn about. Because I think there are some people who have that and can access that, but I definitely think it's not for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the same thing about George and kind of his work. Even if you go back and watch like old Kobe or MJ interviews, like they will talk about him, mm-hmm. about George, and be like, and just talk about just how instrumental he was in their journey and just being able to, I think there's a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like people hear the word meditation or they hear the word manifestation and they think it's some like dark magic thing that, especially with manifestation, that kind of just happens and it's like in this, you know, ether, whatever world. But the reason I like George's work so much is because he boils it down to like the very basics of it. I mean, he's studied all of the great psychologists and mindfulness experts, but one of my favorite takeaways from him was something that he called the eye of the hurricane and that he passed on to Kobe, especially talks about it quite a bit, about just no matter what's happening around you, like you have all this chaos, everything that's happening around you, this hurricane, and your job and really your goal is to be in the center of the hurricane, right? In the eye of the hurricane, where it's completely calm, where, you know, you don't feel the, you know, the strong winds and all this chaos that's around you. And so if you're into mindfulness, man, I highly suggest you check out his work and mm-hmm. his books. They've yeah, I mean, he's great all around.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many great resources. And I think it's interesting. I think especially bouncing around to so many teams and playing for different people, getting different perspectives from like even just different coaches is really great. I did a mini camp with the Steelers this summer, and the special teams coach had two whiteboards full of really great quotes and like ones that I had never heard of. And I was like, at the end of the weekend, I was like, can I, like, we were done with it. And like, basically all that we had left to do was like go to our hotels and like get our stuff to like go fly home. And I was like, can I go to your office real quick and take a picture of your whiteboard? And I was like, I won't keep any of the football stuff, but like all your quotes, like, can I take a picture of it? He was like, yeah, sure, like, go ahead. And I took pictures of it, and I need to go back and look at some of them, because they were great. They were really, really great.
You brought up the point of kind of bouncing around, especially before you got to the 49ers. You have this thing that I don't know if people are aware of, but for the YouTube, actually, I put videos up on Spotify now too. We'll put up a screenshot of your NFL resume that is on your LinkedIn.
A few more to add on there too.
A few more additions, yeah. A few more bullet points. You're personally the first person that I've seen do this and really spell it out. But I think it's so great because when I think of certain NFL players, like I'll take the Niners, for example, right? Like when I think of Kittle, when I think of Debo, Debo's no longer with the team, obviously, but like all these guys that you just like, you know that they have a long NFL career and that they've been around for a while. And then you just think that that's the norm and that everyone has a 10-year career. But in reality, like that's certainly not the truth. And I've had, you know, athletes on, you know, NFL players on here, and they've all said the same thing. You know, NFL stands for not for long. And so what I've come to appreciate, certainly as a host of this podcast and interviewing others, is just like how turbulent it can all be. So for the audience that's listening, I'll just go through a couple bullet points here just to give them an appreciation of your journey. So you go undrafted. The first bullet point that you have on here, Baltimore Ravens rookie camp, May 2016. Baltimore Ravens mandatory minicamp, June 2016. Seattle Seahawks free agent.
That first minicamp, I wasn't able to walk at my graduation in college because I had to go to minicamp, which it's like, it's just one of those things that like, I never got to experience that because like that's how like important football is. I know like some people don't care, and like honestly, I don't know if I totally care, but I know that like my mom definitely cared. But it was just, that's just one of those crazy things that a lot of people don't think about either,
and they get overlooked. Yeah. And they don't know, right? Like I mean, right? Unless you explicitly tell someone, right? Like they're not going to know that you had to skip your. New England Patriots free agent tryout, October 2016. Green Bay Packers free agent tryout, December 2016. Skipping around here. Jacksonville Jaguars free agent tryout, June 2017. Back to the Packers. Ravens preseason camp, August 2017. San Francisco 49ers free agent tryout. This is your first tryout with the Niners, October 2018. The list goes on and on. Like I said, we'll put a screenshot of it so you can see kind of the entire journey here. But we've talked a lot about, you know, kind of the mental side of football and when you're actually in the game, and you spoke a little bit to the mental toll of not having a team and bouncing around, but I was hoping you could just expand on that a little bit more and really give us an appreciation for like, what does it actually feel like to go to all these free agent tryouts, all these preseason camps, and keep trying and it not clicking until finally in 2020, you sign with the Niners. And then a follow-up question, or it could be a part of your answer, is like, what kept you motivated to keep going?
I mean, there's like so much that happened like in that time between, so like I said, like that fall of my first year out of college, like my first workout since like I was with the Ravens twice that first summer, my first workout was December 2016. And then from December 2016 to, I'm sorry, my wife, I got to make sure she's okay. Okay. Sorry, she had her procedure done. From that first workout with the Packers all the way to getting to the 49ers, like so much happened in those. I mean, there was like 4 years in between that, but like so much happened in those 4 years. So like, I'll try to make it quick, but there's like stories in between where like I can talk about the mental aspect, but like that tryout with,
by the way, don't make it quick. Feel free to go as long as you want.
That first tryout with the Packers was for a futures deal. And so they ended up signing me to a futures deal after they got knocked out of the playoffs that year.
Real quick. What's a futures deal?
Wait, so it's a weird thing. It's like only for like players who are like kind of young. But it's a way for like teams to sign you before the official start of the new year. So like you're just kind of claimed early. And it's really only a thing for younger players. So I signed a futures deal, thought I was going to be the only long snapper in OTAs cause they had an old vet. And then all of a sudden 2 weeks before OTA starts, they signed another guy for me to compete with. I'm at OTAs for 3 weeks. They ended up cutting me for this guy who was like a tight end in college and was converting to long snapper in the NFL. And he was like a little bit stronger than me, a little bit faster than me, but like snapping wise, like I was way ahead of him. But they cut me. And then I think I went on a few tryouts that summer, and then they ended up cutting their vet. Oh, they didn't bring back their vet. So I thought I was going to be the only one on the roster. They cut me for the new guy. And then at the end of camp, right at the end of camp, they cut the new guy and signed their old guy back. 3 games into the season, he like injured his hamstring, and then they signed me. I play four games, go to the bye week, start dating my now wife during that bye week, get back, practice on a Thursday for Monday Night Football that week, and break my foot on November 2nd, 2017. And then I'm not cleared to be fully healthy until February 2018. And like in my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm healthy now. I have four games under my belt. People are going to be calling me like crazy. I'll end up somewhere. Couple tryouts that summer, five tryouts that fall. And it got to the point where like every tryout I was going to was like, you're a really good snapper. We're not going to sign you. But like when you get your chance, like I think you're going to be snapping in the NFL for a long time. And that was like, I mean, you can look like, I don't know, that first one in 2018, who was that? Was that the Patriots probably?
Patriots were in 2017. 2018 was, no, you're right. Patriots, May 2018.
Okay.
Patriots minicamp.
And then my last workout was in December of 2018.
With New York, the Giants.
So how many more in between that? How many did I have in 2018?
2018 in total, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in 2018.
So like during that time, I had all these coaches telling me, oh, you're going to snap for a long time. Oh, you're going to snap for a long time. And it got to the point where like, I believed them at first. And then when everyone was kind of saying that canned line, I was like, is this just the BS that they tell everybody? Like, I was having trouble with it. And I finally, like in between some of those, I had to like tell myself, I was like, well, I'll keep going, but only as long as like when I'm at these workouts, if they're not able to give me something I can work on and I stop learning in this process, like once I stop learning, I'll call it, like I'll be done. Cause if I'm not like growing in any way, you know, if they can't give me anything to help, like help me grow as a snapper, then like, then I just might not be good enough because I just keep getting the same damn answer over and over again. Well, ended up signing a futures deal with the Giants that year, competed with Zach Diassi, who was like a 13-year vet at that time. Great guy. We had a great time during OTAs and training camp. It wasn't like a, sometimes tryouts can be weird because guys are not like hostile, but just like not messing with each other at all. Zach was like a great mentor. And I was snapping the best I had ever snapped in my life at that point. Felt really confident. I thought I was going to beat him out. He and Eli Manning were the last two guys on that roster to win Super Bowls for the Giants. So like they were holding on to him. Didn't end up beating him out. Got cut on cut day, last day of camp. Drove home from New York to Michigan like 9 hours that same day that I got cut. And I got home. I got home and I was in bed that night, like writing out my grocery list. And like, I remember my wife's talked about it a few times. Like when he came back, like he immediately was like ready to get back to work and like start eating healthy again. And like, you know, going and working out and getting ready for the next opportunity. I had additional preseason games under my belt, really good film. Zach hurt his toe. He had like an infected toe for part of training camp. So I actually got more playing time than I would have because we were going to split the halves. So I got like two extra games of film. Got home that night I got cut. The next day I'm out to lunch with my now wife and my parents and I get a call from the Dolphins and I fly out the next day, try out for them. And then I get signed and I play 16 games for them. That season is another story in itself. I absolutely hated my special teams coach. He was an asshole. He treated me like shit. I couldn't have snapped worse that season because like this guy just, he got in my head. And now I know this, like he's known for doing that to specialists. Like it's just the way he is. I don't think he's like purposely trying to get in their head and like ruin them, but it's just the way he is like wired. Like he's ruined plenty of specialists and like a lot of guys haven't come back from it. And another story I was just talking about with my wife. And then even I was talking about it with a few other people recently was I was just snapping like crap. And that off season was 2020. And that's when COVID hit. And like a dumbass, I bought a house in South Florida. Cause I thought I was going to be there for a long time. I replaced a 15-year vet and snapped all season. Surely I'm going to be there for a long time. Dumb, but we had a place with a pool during COVID, which wasn't bad. But with that being said, there were actually a lot of specialists who live in South Florida. So during COVID, we were actually able to get a lot of work together at these fields. So I was still snapping to like my guys that I had played with that season, and I just wasn't snapping like myself. And I remember that season I was really struggling because I was like telling my holder, I'm like, dude, like I'm telling you, like I'm a good snapper, but like this coach has me messed up in the head right now. Like go look at my film. Like there was one day I pulled up my film to Matt and I'm like, dude, watch this. Like I'm a good snapper. I can do this. I'm just like, I'm trying to work through this. And it's like so hard. I wanted to quit football that season. Like I was just miserable. And I didn't even realize it till way later, but like, apparently I didn't really even share any of this with my wife. She didn't know how miserable I was. I just kind of came home and like did my thing and like we were fine. She had no clue how miserable I was. So like, you know, it's another lesson is like, don't bottle it up, like use your support system. But so the draft is happening and I'm watching the draft at home. There's nothing else to do. And all of a sudden I get a text. I get like five texts, like, holy shit, like I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, what? And I like go in the room where the draft was playing and like the Dolphins had just picked a long snapper in the sixth round. And I'm like, oh my God. And then I think later that day I got a call and they cut me. But I'll be damned if I didn't go back out to the field with those specialists the next time that we all went out. I was back to myself like I was with the Giants. Like it was crazy because like when we were snapping earlier in that spring, that coach wasn't around. But like after that, I went back to my old self and I was like, I was snapping to my same holder and I'm like, look, it was literally the monkey was off of my back. Like this coach was just such an asshole. And like when I got cut, it was horrible. Like I thought my, you know, career was going to be over, but like I started snapping like myself again. And that mental weight was just totally off of me. And I went back to normal and was snapping great. And those guys weren't able to go to OTAs for a while because of COVID. And I got so much extra work in that I otherwise wouldn't have with specialists. It was nice because as the spring went on, more guys came down to South Florida and I got work with a lot of like active punters and kickers. And like, I was able to showcase what I could do to some of these guys. And I remember one of the guys had two rookie snappers on their roster that season. And he's like, you're way better than them. Like, as soon as I get back, like, I'm going to tell my coach, like, he needs to bring you in. I never ended up going there, but like, that's what I was trying to use that almost as like a tryout and like get these guys to like go to their coaches and be like, this kid's good. So there's just so many mental aspects. And then after that, like, I did get picked up by the Niners like week four of 2020 and, you know, just constant improvement year over year. I had Robbie Gold, who's a really good mentor to me, and really helped me like develop like as a pro and not just like on the field stuff, but like all the behind the scenes stuff, taking care of my body, how to act in the building, when I should show up, like when I should leave, like all that stuff was just like such a big contribution to like my success that I've had. And I'm 31 now and like I still got a lot of gas left in the tank, so I'm definitely not ready to hang them up. But it is frustrating. I was cut like 2 days into free agency and I had another year left on my deal. So like a lot of these guys who go into the offseason knowing they're free agents, their agents are talking to guys like at teams constantly, even, you know, even when they're not supposed to, like at the combine. That's one of the biggest like under the table like free agent discussion times. I wasn't able to have any of that. And then 2 days of free agency goes by and then I get cut. By that, I got cut on a Wednesday. By Friday, all of the long snapping spots were filled up everywhere. I have no doubt in my mind I would have ended up somewhere. And now it's just one of those things like teams just don't typically shake it up like that. Like, oh, let's cut this young guy. And also the OTAs and even training camp is a time for these coaches. It's kind of inconsequential because there's a few of us on the streets right now that are really, really good snappers, that like these coaches, they want to get these young guys in, really evaluate them, try to develop them as much as possible. And then if they aren't working out towards the end of camp, you sign a vet and it's kind of like a Band-Aid. Like, you know, these guys are proven. This last season, I played my 100th game in the NFL. Like, I have plenty of film. They know who I am. They know who all the guys on the street are. And it's like, it's kind of inconsequential for the coaches, but it's just like it's just been weird because I am in a totally different place now. I have money, I have a wife, I have two kids, you know, my house is great. Like, I have this anime weeb office of my own. I didn't have that. I was in a condo with my girlfriend, now wife. Life circumstances are way different, but all of the lessons that I learned as a free agent, it was just, for weeks I woke up at like 2 a.m. to go pee, and like I'm like, holy shit, like it hasn't been a dream. Like, I'm actually not a 49er anymore. So there's just like so many things over the years, and there's so many, many stories even inside of all that stuff. So I mean, it's been a grind, and I loved my time with the Niners. I wanted to finish my career there. I wanted to be there as long as my body could handle it. But, you know, we got a new special teams coach this offseason, and he had other ideas, I guess.
I want to ask you about your experience with the Niners. Obviously, being as a Niner, you know, being a huge Niners fan, I can't. I just have to ask. But like, what does a long snapping competition look like? Like, what makes for a good long snapper?
A good long snapper, it's quite a few things. I think the number one thing that's like the biggest differentiator from like college guys coming out now going to the pros is like all the teams in the NCAA now, they run that like really spread out punt where there's like 2 or 3 yards in between each guy, and like, you know, there's no rules. The rules are different in college versus the pros as far as who can run down the field. And the pros, only the gunners can run down the field before the ball gets punted. In college, as soon as the ball snapped, anyone can run down the field and cover immediately. So like as a snapper in college, you get to rip the ball and just immediately start covering. And the pros, like, because of that rule, there's 8 other guys who are going to be rushing the punt most of the time. So you have to get your head up quicker. You can't watch the ball as long as you can in college. So I think the two biggest differentiators are like being able to block, and then if you can like control your laces on field goal snaps. And then like, but I always say, like, by the time you reach the NFL, or like you're knocking on the door of the NFL, like you should be able to snap a punt ball. Like, you shouldn't have to ever worry about your accuracy. Like, you should really only be focused on blocking, you know. If you can't snap an accurate punt snap, you shouldn't even be attempting to try to block, really. So it's one of those things.
At the beginning of this podcast, you talked about the unconscious competence, mm-hmm. From your days at Michigan State. What do you think? I'm assuming, you know, during your career, you reached that point, especially with long snapping. A, is that true? And B, what helped you reach that point of unconscious competence? Was it just reps?
It really is just reps. And then alongside, like, even when you're like learning how to block, and like, because there's like kind of steps to it, it's like, first you just have to be able to get your head up fast enough to even have a chance of getting in front of a guy. And, you know, you have an idea of where your guy is, but like most snappers are look snappers, so they're looking behind them through their legs at the punter. So like you can kind of spot where they line up, but the second your head goes down, kind of all bets are off, really. Like, they could move. Are you able to hear them? Are you able to, like, you know, are your guys on the line giving you a call that they moved or the formation changed? Is your PP saying hold, so you can like raise your head up, see where they are, go back down, snap. And then the other thing is just like just the film breakdown, you know, what coordinators have done, what have they done at this place versus, you know, in their career. A lot of special teams coordinators, they just kind of do the same crap over the years. So it's like, even if you have a guy at a new team, if you just go look at the old team he coached for, like, you can pretty much know how he's going to operate. Very rarely does like a coach go to a new team and like the head coach is like, hey, you need to like not call as many rushes. I want you to like try to set up returns more. Sometimes that happens, but most of the time, like, if you have their track record, they have their favorite rushes, they have like their base looks and everything like that, then you know what to expect that week. And then they'll throw in some curveballs. Then you got to make sure you don't have any tells. Some guys are like tapping the ball and then they like stop and then they snap, and then other guys are like moving their butt, and then they pause for a second, and then they snap, or like their PP is like, ready, ready, oh, purple, purple. Put their mouthpiece in, set, and it's like you can time it. So like you got to erase those things. You got to self-scout. You got to do this. You got to do that. So like there's so many levels to even like get to where you need to be unconsciously competent in the NFL. Like it just takes time. And I felt like I really was reached that point. Probably my 2023 season. I knew how to prepare at that point. And I could do it, and it was quick. You know, it didn't take me a whole long time to like realize what they were doing. And then, you know, it just kind of becomes second nature.
You talked about the preparation and how instrumental Robbie Gould was in that. And listen, I love Robbie Gould like no other. Good as gold, baby. I still remember his kick against the Packers, that one playoff run when Hufanga had that block punt return for a touchdown. Give me a little more detail. What makes I hear a lot of players in the NFL, how they're an outstanding professional and you do things the right way. Like, what does that actually look like?
Honestly, for a specialist, like at least how it was at the Niners is like the special teams meeting was like the third meeting of the day. And like they were pretty lax as long as you were doing what you were supposed to and like performing, like especially at the Niners. Like if you act like a pro, you're going to get treated like one. The worst is like when someone's not acting like a pro and you have to like, they have to be babysat basically. So it was one of those things is like, once I like earned my spot, was doing well and everything like that, like really technically if I wanted to roll into the building 10 minutes before meeting started, I could have. But it's Robbie's pretty type A, and I think he would admit that. So he like overly thinks about this stuff, and it's important to him because he also like came into the league at a very different time. There were real two-a-days, and you as a kicker were kicking 30 to 40 balls each practice. There weren't sports recovery days, sports science recovery days and stuff like that. Like that didn't exist. It was a whole different brand. So like his last year that I played with him was his 18th year. Like he grew up, he came up in a different era, very different than when he left. And it was one of those things that, you know, he's done it for a long time. Why wouldn't I listen to him? And there were people who came in and out that didn't listen to him. And like, sometimes they didn't last long and other times they were fine. But you know, one of those things was like as a specialist, like we don't get a lot of respect in the first place. So it's like, you know, you should probably come in like when the other guys are coming in and like be seen in the locker room before everybody goes to their first meetings of the day. And like, if you're going to be in the building, don't dick around and like, you know, be an idiot, like get your recovery work in, like find your routine. And like, that's a hard thing to do. Like not a lot of college kids know how to like find their routine, but it's very impactful on like your on the field play. I'd say that's a big like learning curve thing for a lot of young guys, especially specialists too. And so same thing, you know, Robbie would always beat me, but once he was gone, I was definitely the first specialist in the building every single day. And you know, it was important to him. And like when I was in there, like being able to even just chit chat with the guys before they go to their first meetings was like, that became important to me. And I think it did. I hope it had an impact. Maybe other guys didn't think about it, but like at least I was in the building and I had a solid like hour and a half before my first meeting. And that was a lot of time to like get my recovery routine going and like stretching before meetings. So I was like actually like kind of loose just for the day, get my, whether it's my metabolism going or just like just getting a little warm, cooling off. You know, I wouldn't like work out or anything, but I would like do these certain stretches and postures and poses and sauna, cold tub, all this stuff, and just get ready for the day. And it really helped with locking your mind in for those meetings. And then when it was time to practice, like you were kind of already ready in a sense. So it was impactful to me.
A couple more questions, man, and then I'll let you go. Was there a specific stadium that like you knew going into the week, like you see that team on the schedule and you're like, fuck man, like I really don't want to play there?
Mostly just like outdoor teams in December. Like Buffalo last year was the worst snow game I've ever played in my life. And I played at Michigan State. Like I had experience in the cold. I was fine in the cold, but it just sucks when you're playing in Santa Clara most of the year, where it's like 70 and sunny for most of your season, even sometimes in playoffs. So like just mostly those. There was no stadium that was like intimidating to me. Probably the opposing stadium I felt like most comfortable in was Dallas, because especially with the Niners being in the NFC, I'd actually played in Dallas quite a bit by the time I got to the Niners. I played there twice in college, two Cotton Bowls in a row. And then my second game with the Packers Yeah, it was my second game with the Packers was in Dallas. And then I played in Dallas with the Dolphins. And then I played in Dallas like three or four more times in my career. So I've played there a ton. I liked playing in Dallas. It's a great place. Jerry World, great place to play.
So is the whole like, you know, a warm weather team going to a cold city? Is that thing true? Because I see that with the Dolphins all the time, too, especially when recently, not the playoffs, but a couple of years ago when they were going up to, I think it was Kansas City for a playoff game. They're like, oh, you know, the Dolphins going up to Kansas City, you know, warm weather team going up to the cold.
Dumb asses coming out shirtless. Like, it's like,
yeah, you're right.
Nobody cares.
Cool.
You were literally doing that for the camera. Because at least the way I see it, you know, I'm not playing against corners and stuff like that most of the time, like unless they're on punt rush or something. But like, the guys who really matter are probably not looking across the field and seeing who has their shirt off. Like they're doing it for themselves and they're doing it for the cameras. It's so stupid. Now, Michigan State, like our O-linemen, like we're not allowed to wear sleeves. That's like a culture thing. Like whatever, that's fine. But like when you're coming out shirtless, it's like, who are you doing that for? I think it's so stupid. So I think guys set themselves up for failure doing that, honestly. I think there was some college team last year who did it and they like ran back in to put their shirts on because it was actually so cold. I mean, that sucks playing against the Packers. That game where I ran and got the ball for Robbie, like that game was miserable too. We had another one almost exactly like that last year about that cold, maybe not even that cold. That year was insane. It was like a 0 degree wind chill. Those just suck, those outdoor cold games. Those are the only ones I like roll my eyes at. But like once you're there and it's like 20 minutes till kickoff, it's like, all right, too late to worry about it now, let's go. Got
might as well accept
six
it
layers on and ugh.
Yeah,
it's annoying. Do you think this is good?
Yeah. Do you think the same is true when people, I mean, you play with the Dolphins, so you play in Miami. Like, do you think it's the same when like Buffalo comes down to Miami, especially in like September?
I think it's different because you can actually like the cold is one thing because it can hurt. But like the heat in Miami, my first two games there, I struggled. I'll never forget that first game in Miami. I played it. I came in from pregame warmups and my body was dry as if I had already finished a game. And I was like, I actually have to go play in this now. And those first two games in Miami, we lost by a combined 110-10. We had, I think we punted 13 times between those two games. So like I was getting a lot of action. Adapting to that heat was really hard. I think teams have harder times adapting to that kind of heat than they do the cold, personally. Just the physiological toll. And with that, I learned some great lessons. I learned exactly how to hydrate my body the way I need it. The exact like products that they have, you know, they have like liquid IV, they have Element, they have Drip Drop, they have Right Stuff. They have all these different things. And actually when I was that preseason, when I was with the Giants, we did a sweat test that year in camp. And so they like shave a little bit of like your thigh hair and they put like almost like a band-aid on it, and then you go out and practice, and then after practice they collect it and send it in and they see exactly what minerals you're sweating out. So like I think I sweat out, I think it's something like a lot of zinc and a lot of sodium. Other guys, their levels are different. And so they found like the best products for us to consume to make sure that we're replacing like exactly or approximately like what we're going to lose when we sweat, to not like to avoid cramping and that stuff. So like, luckily I had that, and luckily I knew exactly what to take. But even just the protocol of like, because it is so hot in South Florida that like I would have to start taking some of those like electrolyte packets and salt packets. Like I would take one like 4 hours before practice, one an hour before practice, and like one like right after the first period to not cramp, which is a shit ton of sodium, but it had to be done.
Dude, my parents live in Miami, so like I'm down there fairly often, but like I'll go for a walk on the beach. I know, tough life. And I'm like, I'm dripping in sweat. Dude. And the worst part is that the water is like 90 degrees. Yeah. So like, yeah. Like I grew up in California pretty much. So like obviously the Bay Area, I've lived in LA for a couple of years. You jump into that water and it's like 50 degrees. And actually, I mean, depending if it's a summer day, actually can be refreshing. But you jump into the Atlantic, you know, down in Miami, or even like into the Gulf up in Tampa or anywhere on that coast, like that's a hot tub. Like you're jumping into a hot tub.
And I will say, like, that summer I was stuck there for COVID, like I was training outside a lot and actually like jogged more than I ever had in my life, just like going on runs and stuff, like a couple miles. I will say, training in that weather, when you go to any other climate, it's you're a chilling. Joke. Dude, I've never been more well conditioned than when I was training in Miami. It's crazy. Like I even went out to Santa Clara and they're like, oh my God, it's so hot. But it's like such a dry heat that I was still in like sweats and like a loose thin like cover on the top and bottom, and like didn't think anything of it. And at that point I was so used to it, I was like, why would I like I'm not gonna get like soft. So I like tried to make myself hot during practice because I realized like how much it was helping my conditioning. And then I replaced it with saunaing, but like same benefits. So yeah, it's that was a huge thing I learned about just the hydration and then just training in that heat.
Dude, well, you mentioned tennis early on and how you played in high school. I'm a big tennis fan. I play with friends recreationally and stuff. But I love watching the sport too.
It when I retire.
Dude, you should.
Country Club King.
The Country Club, there you go. But they had that huge or that really famous like tennis center practice facility in Sarasota. And I've noticed that there's like a bunch of like tennis, I mean, the USTA centers in Orlando, like just a bunch of like tennis practice centers all up and down Florida. I'm why is it Florida? Like there has to be something going on. And then, you know, it finally clicked. I was like, oh yeah, because it's so hot here. Like if you're conditioned in this heat, like when you go play a tournament, when you go to the US Open up in New York or anywhere else, like you're like, oh, like this is, you know, this is nothing. Yeah. It's funny too, because I mean, I'm not one to judge because I'm not the one playing, but it's funny when the Niners, I think even this year, they had said that they're not going to wear their black jerseys like in September for home games because of the heat and whatever. I'm like, yeah, I don't, you know, 85 degrees in Santa Clara is one thing, but 120 or 110 on the field in Miami, that's a whole different beast.
Yeah, I remember that the second game I played in, I think it was the first or the second, we played against Baltimore and they were wearing all blacks against us. And I was like, oh, like this is an advantage for us. And they kicked the shit out of me. I mean, it was like 40 to like 3 or something like that. Like they kicked their ass and it didn't affect them at all.
Yeah. That's wild. I have to ask you, man, two more questions on the Niners. And I promise we'll finish off this pod. Kyle Shanahan, just what is he like as a coach? Like, what is it that we fans don't see behind the scenes that kind of speak to the type of coach that he is?
Yeah, I think the main thing is like to my detriment, some would argue, like I'm active online, like I'm in the 49ers subreddit since I joined the team, and I'm like I get Niners stuff on my For You page on Twitter, so like I see what people say about Kyle and stuff like that, and like some things there's like a nugget of truth, but it just gets so exaggerated that it's like kind of just a bit out of control. But what I would say is like he's known for being like an offensive genius. What I will say is like he conducts his like team meetings like in such a way that like I've never known more about football than when I was sitting in his meetings. And like, he's able to explain it that, you know, in a way that even a long snapper can understand, I guess you could say. But Trent Williams has been quoted as saying like he learned so much about offenses and like angles and gaps and all this stuff just from sitting in his meetings. Like, he actually teaches you football. And because he's a, you know, was a coordinator for a long time, and he's, you know, basically a prodigy with his dad being who he is. Like, it's one of those things, if you're an offensive coach, you can coach the defense in a way of like knowing what their responsibilities are, how to beat it and stuff. And so just on both sides of the ball, it was just like super impactful. The way he led his team meetings during the week were really amazing. Wednesday was so awesome. He goes through, you know, a what it takes meeting on what's it going to take to beat this team this week. And he goes through, you know, their offense and says like three things that they do really well. And then he like plays clips, and then he'll go through our defense and say the things that we can do that we do well to like stop it. And then vice versa for offense, and a little bit about special teams, and like just the depth that he goes in. And like, he really teaches everybody about our offense, especially during OTAs and training camp, or OTAs mostly, because we all have like big team meetings then. You just learn so much football from him. And he's a chill guy. And like I said, there, it's not a daycare center. I've been in other teams where like there are just meetings scheduled all day long to make sure you're in the building and you're focused on football, and they don't give you any time out of there. Like, he gets in, gets the stuff done, and gets out. And I think a lot of it is like, there's a lot of support staff in San Francisco that like helps break down film and stuff like that. So I think the coaches actually have a lot of work, but it's one of those things like they want pros in that building that can handle themselves. And just like, they're not going to babysit you. They're going to treat you like pros, and like, they expect you to learn it at their pace. And you know, it's worked for them. They've been very successful over the last 8 years that he's been there, I think. Yeah, 8.
It's, I mean, you mentioned being in the Niners subreddits and just seeing the stuff pop up on social media. I've asked Josh Dobbs this question. I had Cesar Ruiz, Saints offensive lineman, on the pod, and we were actually talking a lot about social media and just as a player, like how much attention you pay to it and how deep you want to get into it. And Cesar was saying like, hey, listen, man, during the season, I pretty much delete Twitter. Like, I just don't need to see it. Like, I just don't. It's just information that I don't need. It's like, if I have a bad game, like, trust me, like, I know I had a bad game. I don't need, you know, Joe Schmo telling me like, hey, you know, you suck. It's like, yeah, like, I know I had a bad game. But you seem to have, I guess, maybe a different approach, maybe, or you seemed at least more active on social media, and you kind of laughed it off saying it might have been to your detriment. Like,
and that was honestly like other people's projection.
Yeah.
Not even how I feel about it. I mean, like, to answer your question, like, I've kind of been like terminally online since I was like pretty young. And so just growing up in like some of the like communities I've been in, even today after Elon bought Twitter, like the stuff that I read now is just kind of a joke compared to the way the internet used to be. Whether that's super healthy or not, I don't know, but like, it's just one of those things where like, also like, again, I'm outspoken. One, you know, the common thought is like, it's not good for any player to like really be outspoken on social media. I think that's flipped a little bit with how many guys have their own individual podcast now. I know people still like don't like it that much. It's like, focus on football. But like, with me, I've just always, I'm a very talkative guy, as you can probably realize. Like, and I have my opinions, and I do get political on Twitter, which a lot of people don't like. But it's just one of those things where, you know, if people crap on me or whatever, I kind of also like, not as like a scare tactic to myself, but like, I'm like, you know what? I am outspoken on Twitter, but I'm also a really good long snapper. So I'm kind of using that as like, don't give these guys a reason to like attack your long snapping. Like, if they want to shit on you, just like, it, maybe just do it because they think you're annoying, which that's pretty much it. You know, people can rewrite history and say I was a shitty long snapper when I was with the Niners, but like, I wasn't. I only got better, and in 2023 I was a Pro Bowl alternate. So like, if there's any external validation that I needed, like, I guess that was it. We ended up playing in the Super Bowl, so it wasn't even a big deal. Like, I know how I am as a long snapper. I know like my ability level. So like, and I also know that nobody knows anything about long snapping. And it's funny because I've had good games where I see a few tweets where people were saying I did shitty and it just wasn't true. And then I've been able to escape games where I did have a not so great snap or two and nobody says a word. So like that too, like just kind of ingrained in my mind, I was like, nobody knows what the hell they're talking about. And when I talk about long snapping in depth, like there's so much stuff that just the average Joe just doesn't know about. Most of the time they don't care about it, but also like that's the thing is like if you don't care to learn about long snapping, then I don't even take them as like real football fans, honestly. Because if you don't know the value of a long snapper, and I'm not even talking about myself, but in general, like if you don't know the value of a good long snapper, then like it's not even worth like thinking about that person's opinion. So that's kind of the way that I look at it. I've always been able to handle it. I'm always online. My degree was media and information with a specialization in interactive and social media. So all my friends told me I got a Twitter degree and they're not totally wrong. But that's just how I've always operated. I'm curious.
It's called X now, Tabor. Just
yeah, for if you're a certain crowd.
All jokes aside though, like to your point, long snapping is one of those things that you don't really notice unless something goes like terribly wrong. Like especially like if you know whoever's lining up for a kick, unless you know long snapper just fucks it up, like you're not gonna be like, the average fan is not gonna be like, oh wow, that was a really great snap.
For example, the game winner that Robbie hit on the call, I think Joe Buck said high snap, and it's like, if you look at it, I guess it looks high. It could look high. But if you know the inner workings of how I snap, Mitch knows that in those pressure situations, the last thing I'm going to do is take anything off of the speed of the ball. Because I think in general for long snappers, especially for myself, if you try to aim, you slow yourself down. And if you slow yourself down, you're not snapping the way that you normally snap and shit just goes wrong. Mitch knows in those high pressure situations, I am absolutely snapping it as hard as I can. And so that ball is, the faster you snap it, as long as it's a clean spiral, it's going to kind of keep raising up. And he knows those high pressure situations, they're going to be right at his face mask level. So like it might look high, but like people don't know the way I operate with Mitch or whoever my holder is. Like Mitch knew exactly where the ball was going to be. So like, was it technically higher than what is considered perfect normally? I guess, but in that situation, it was a perfect ball. It's just like little things like that. Like people just even, I wouldn't expect another team's coach to know that. But if I sit down and have a conversation with them and just tell them that, they're going to be like, oh, okay. And just not think about it again. It's like, that's just what he does. So
that's a really interesting point. I clearly never thought about that, but that makes a ton of sense when you explain it.
Yeah, it pisses me off every time I watch that clip because it's like, snap is high. And I'm like, okay.
God damn it, Joe Buck. Yeah. Interesting. You gave me a different perspective. I like that.
Yeah.
I have to ask, man, with the Jake Moody news, there's been a lot circulating and you're on social media. You've seen the Jake Moody slander or I guess the celebration from a lot of Niners fans when he was released. We don't need to talk about his performance on the field, any of that. I was just hoping, since you were part of that group, if you could just give us a perspective on Jake that maybe people don't realize, and really kind of the angle that I'm attacking this question from. Listen, I get it. As NFL players, you all have a job. If you don't perform right, there's consequences. So, like,
you know, there's the NFL not for long, but it's also what have you done for me lately league. Like, it's,
right,
if you're not making kicks, if you're not punting the ball the right way, like you're gonna get cut.
Right. I was going to say, like, we all know Jake struggles on the field and he wasn't, I mean, he missed the 27 yarder last weekend, right? I mean, that's just not going to fly. But just like him as a person, like give us some insight into who Jake was.
Yeah. I mean, he's a quiet guy. It's funny 'cause like he went to my rival school, U of M. I went to MSU.
Oh, true. So, yeah.
He lives like 20 minutes from me. He's a great prototype for like to make a good kicker as far as like mentally in the way he just operates. He's a quiet guy. He can be, I guess some people would think he's awkward if they don't know him really well, but like when you get to know him, he's like awesome. He's like actually hilarious, even though his humor is like pretty dry. But like, I mean, as far as like the intangibles, like he's an incredible kicker. And like, you know, going from Robbie to Jake, like as far as like good kickers go, you know, I was with Jason Sanders. He's done a great job. I think he's banged up right now with a hip or something like that. But like, I've been around really good kickers. He's a really, really good kicker. He has a lot of talent. He has a big leg. And I think what happened was, is I think, and people are rewriting history right now on Twitter, and it really pisses me off because like his rookie year was a fantastic rookie year. He played in the Super Bowl his rookie year, and he broke two records, one of which got broken 20 minutes later by Harrison Butker. But then he also broke another record by having two kicks like over 50 yards in the Super Bowl or something like that. Like, he is able to do incredible stuff. Did he miss the game winner against Cleveland? Yeah. And, you know, I was just talking to a podcast the other day about like there's a lot of like you can miss a kick and have a lot of great things to say about the kick. Like when that ball left his foot against the Browns and it missed wide left, like it was when it came off his foot, I've seen the ball travel over my head a million times. Even at that point, it was a really good kick that he hit. The wind was a little wonky in Cleveland that day. There's a million factors, you know, and I said this to my wife actually yesterday, like, you could have four things go wrong during a field goal operation and still make those kicks. Like, that's possible. And then there's another kick where you can have two things go wrong and they miss it. Or it could be a perfect operation and they miss it, or vice versa. There could be any combination of things that could go right or wrong. And I'm not saying it's a coin flip, because it's not, but like there's just so many factors that go into it. And so like like whether these people want to admit it or not, like he had a phenomenal rookie year. He started out his second year really, really great. I think he was like 15 of 16 before he got hurt. And I've talked to Jake about this, and we've had conversations about it, and he knows I wouldn't say anything online that I wouldn't say to him or isn't true. But like, and I learned a lesson in it too. This whole podcast has basically been about lessons that I've learned in this time. And he went through something that I hadn't experienced yet. I think he came back from injury too soon. I think he should have given another week or two. But you have to understand, yes, he has that cloud of being a third round pick above his head. And at that time, the Niners didn't place him on IR. So he was taking up a roster spot during the season and had like a 3-week window to be expected back. But he wanted to come back as soon as possible to help his team. That was the pressure that he felt while he was recovering. So I think that's only natural for a guy to feel like, I don't want to be taking up an extra roster spot. I want to come back and I want to help my team, because that's who he is. Like, it was like noble the way he did that. But I think he should have waited another week or two, gotten a little more healthy. Because I think what happened was he came back from injury too soon. His injury affected some of his kicks. And then I do think it became like a little bit of a mental thing by the end of the season. But that high ankle sprain, if you've seen that video of him, I mean, it got twisted under him. Like, that's serious. That's not a 3-week recovery to begin with. It's a months long recovery to feel like yourself again. I had one of those in high school. It took me months after the season to like feel like I could really go. But like, there's certain things you can get over and still perform and do stuff. And then, truth be told, I think this offseason, the new coach came in. He probably did what he felt was right. But the way I look at it is, a coaching change is a big change to begin with for any specialist. Two, he took away Jake's entire support system in that room. You got two new coaches, you got your special teams coordinator, you got his assistant, and then you get rid of his snapper and his holder in the same year. That's tough. And, you know, I think whether it had as big of an impact as I think it had or didn't. I don't know. But like, that's just the way I see it is like, I don't know. I don't know many people who could like really succeed at a high level when that happens. But all of these things can be true at once. We're in the NFL and we get paid to make kicks. That's it. Like, we can, like, there are factors that are true that affect this stuff. But at the end of the day, if we're not making kicks, that's that. And you got to go. Same thing with receivers. If you could run the most crisp routes, but if that ball touches your hands and you don't lock it in every single time, you're going to get cut. Like, it's just the fact of the matter. And it sucks, but it's also why the NFL is so competitive and so good most of the time.
I just want to clarify too, like, the reason I ask is genuinely, like, I'm curious because I love to understand the full picture. And with Jake, and kind of to the point that you're alluding, it's not like one night he just, or one morning he woke up and he was like, all right, now I can't make kicks anymore. Like, he was a star at UM, right? Like, he, to your point, had a great rookie year, tons of talent. Like, the kid's good at kicking the football.
Hell yeah.
But the reason I ask is A, because I want to understand the full story, and then B, I want to give the audience kind of the perspective, because to your point on Twitter, everyone's just like, oh, Jake Moody sucks. Or you go on TikTok and it's like, oh, Jake Moody sucks. It's like, all right. But like, there's probably something that happened that, right, put him in this position to where he's now not, he's missing 27 yarders. Like, an NFL kicker doesn't miss a 27 yarder, especially the kind of talent that he has, just overnight. Like, things add up. That's. And so one other story that I remember too is like Mooney Ward. I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago. Was it his baby daughter passed away or there was a miscarriage? Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think it might have been against the Chiefs. I can't remember. I think we were playing at home. But he had a terrible game, like a really bad game. And everyone on Twitter was like, oh, Mooney Ward sucks. Like, he's washed. And then, like, the next day it comes out that his daughter had passed away that week. So it's like, all right. Like, again.
And then people are talking like, maybe he should have just sat out.
But right.
Like, if he would have sat out and like not been on the injury report, people would have been like, what the hell's going on? It's like,
yeah,
you know, I don't want to touch on it too much because I've talked about it at length before. But like the Debo clip, like it's a clip and like it looks really bad. And trust me, I've gotten plenty of people on Twitter tagging me in that gif even this week after Moody got cut. Like, I've seen it a lot. It looks terrible. But like by the next week, Debo and I were fine. It wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't a big deal. Like, it gets blown out of proportion. People have this big of a perspective,
right,
when the world is so wide and there's so many factors going on. And like, dude, I really started to realize it as my family started growing. A lot of these older guys have families that they're taking care of. And like, just like, I implore people who do have families, think about all the stress you have, even with, you know, a normal 9 to 5, which is stressful. Then you got kids to come home to, you got bedtime, you got this, you got that. Then add that to like the most physical job in the world, arguably, is getting beat to shit by other grown men in pads running full speed at each other. Some of these guys have kids to go home to. Some of these guys have family members across the country that need money that they're making in the NFL. Like, there's so much going on at once that like, you got to find the balance, and some guys can handle it and some guys can't. And it sucks because if people had these perspectives, they'd probably be a little less critical. Adding the anonymity of like being online, like there's layers of empathy that get cut off, lack of perspective. It's just the perfect storm to just shit on guys just trying their best and like literally trying to feed their family and like provide for themselves for the future. That's all it is. And like, that's what's frustrating. Nobody wants to succeed more than the people who are being talked about, really.
And I really like that last point that you made. And also, like, there's just so many stories. Like, if you, like, Drew Brees, the year before the Saints won the Super Bowl, or during the offseason, I think it was his grandma. I hope I'm getting that right. His grandma passed away. Like, obviously, like, a huge moment in his life, but he still came back. He still performed well. Obviously, they won the Super Bowl. Cesar Ruiz, who I said I had on the podcast, his grandma passed away a week before his first NFL game. Like, obviously, he's going to have a huge impact on him. Like, he was super close with his grandma. Like, like we said, at the end of the day, like, you're paid for your performance. It's a what have you done for me recently type of league. We get all of that. Like, I'm not making excuses for why players are going out there and performing poorly.
There's no excuse. Like,
it's just, it helps. Let's push a little more empathy and understand that, you know, these are humans. and shit goes wrong. Like, I get 6 hours of sleep one night instead of eight, and I wake up the next morning and maybe I miss an email at work. Maybe I miss a...
And like, you're going to beat yourself up over it, even though it's like relatively a small thing, but in that moment, yeah, it's a big thing. Like, if someone called you and said a family member died, like, then you wouldn't worry about that email anymore. And it's just like,
right.
I do think back to like when I was like first dating my wife, like there were so few things to actually worry about during the day that like, it makes me think back like, damn, like I remember like going to practice and coming home and just being able to like chill for 4 hours and then go to sleep. And then like most recently, like this last season, my wife was pregnant with our second. I had a 2-year-old. My wife gave birth on Thursday and we left to go play in Miami on Friday this last season. Like, I got no sleep that week.
Right.
I took my wife into the hospital at 2 a.m. that morning. They sent her back home, gave her some medicine. And then like, I was warming up. I had done punt period. I was warming up for field goal period. And John Lynch came up to me and was like, hey, your wife's in labor. Like, go back to the locker room. I'm like, oh shit. And I like text my wife. I'm like, do I need to jog or do I need to sprint? And she's like, you can jog. I was like, got it. And like that night, my son was born, and I don't think I fell asleep till midnight, 1 a.m. And then I think the way the night and the delivery went, like I was like, hey, like, I don't think I'm going to sleep on this bed anymore. I'm just going to drive to the facility and sleep on one of the water beds that we had. And so I got 3 hours of sleep that night, basically, before I had another like full practice or like a walkthrough before I had to like fly out to Miami. So like, there's so much going on all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to ask this question. As a 49ers fan, it pains me, and I'm sure it pains you a lot too, but 2021 Rams NFC Championship game, 2022 Eagles NFC Championship game, or the Super Bowl in 2023 against the Chiefs, which loss hurts the most?
The 21 Rams. And Robbie said this, and I didn't know what he meant until I experienced it a few times, is like losing a conference championship like kind of hurts worse than like losing the Super Bowl, because like if you're in the Super Bowl, at least you have a chance to win. If you lose in the conference championship, you don't know what could have happened. Like, I fully believe if we would have beaten the Rams that year, we would have won the Super Bowl against the Bengals that year. We had already beat them that season. And we like really hit a really good stride those playoffs too. I think we would have rolled in there with a week's rest and like done a really good job. The reason why it doesn't hurt as bad, like the Eagles suck, don't get me wrong, but like, it was funny because like you actually had like 3 quarters of a football game to process what was going on because it was happening to you in real time. But by the time we got on the plane, it was like, we didn't have a quarterback. We didn't have a shot to win the game. Like, it was processed and done by the time we got on the buses to leave. Like, you can't win an NFL game without an active quarterback. I mean, that was why I think it was like an easier pill to swallow. Like, did it suck? Yeah. But like, you didn't even have a shot to win. So it's like, what are you going to worry about? The Rams game was like, we had overcome a lot. We squeaked into the playoffs and we beat Dallas in Dallas. We beat the number one seed in the NFC that year, MVP Aaron Rodgers that year. And like, we were rolling and we had beaten the Rams 6 out of the last 6 times we played them. Like, we had a shot. And that one definitely sucked the most. I mean, the Super Bowl, like, I was very, very grateful for it. Like, even right after, like, I didn't have too many qualms about it. But like, when you think about like some of the things that went in on that game, like, there's definitely stuff that I'm frustrated about happened. But a lot of most of the mistakes that happen, it's just a football game. Who makes the least amount of mistakes? And that's what it is. And like, yeah, that's kind of the main thing, is like, at least we had the opportunity. We were right there. And especially now that I'm off the team, like, I think it hurts a little bit more that we lost the Super Bowl. Because like, I mean, I was with the Niners for 5 years. I think I left like an impact on like real fans who like knew about me and like what I was contributing with the team. And it was a really great run. It was 3 NFC championships in a row. Like, it's great. And a Super Bowl appearance, like, that's impactful. And like, that makes an impact on a lot of fans. But I just, like, now I'm just a little remiss that we didn't win the Super Bowl that year, because it's like, you know, Robbie always said, like, when you win a Super Bowl, you're not Taper Pepper anymore. You're Super Bowl champion Taper Pepper. And I think with the way things ended in San Francisco, I think, like, that sucks probably the most. And I don't know if I've told, like, a lot of people that, but, like, that's probably what sucks the most.
Dude, I got to say, like, I mean, with your time with the Niners, you talk about making an impact. Like, you were... It's funny, for a position that certainly doesn't get as much attention, right? Like, you know, long snapper, you're one of my favorite players just because of how active you are on social media and just interacting with fans and the personality too. Like, I mean, I can tell you from a fan's perspective, like, we just love guys that are outgoing and that show off their personality. And I feel like you were always good at doing that and just connecting with us. And I voted you for the Pro Bowl.
Yeah. One more thing I didn't like, I haven't mentioned recently or even when I was playing, but like, one thing I do want out there, and if I do any more, like, specifically, like, Niners podcasts or even just talk about my time with the Niners, is, like, one of my, like, proudest accomplishments was, like, my last year there, I was the longest active member of the Social Justice Committee. And that was, like, really, really great. It meant a lot to me. Like I said, I'm active on Twitter and, like, specifically, like, politically, like, I'm not afraid to share my opinion. And I just don't think a lot of, like, people know that. And it was, like, something that I took seriously, and something that, like, meant a lot to me. And there's a lot of history inside of the Niners building of, like, social justice movements, like, obviously Colin Kaepernick, but Dr. Harry Edwards is, like, an integral part of the Niners history. He was right there with Bill Walsh when he was coaching there. You know, the dude was, like, one of the founding members of the Black Panthers. He helped orchestrate the Olympic fist raising at the podium. He is an icon when it comes to social justice, and, like, the amount of face-to-face time I had with him, even outside of being on the social justice committee, was, like, super impactful. And it was really amazing. And, like, I was, of all the things I'm, like, proud of, like, on the field, and even now I'm, like, getting a little emotional about it, like, being a part of that, like, was one of my favorite things of being a Niner.
Dude, I love that, man. I appreciate you sharing that with me. Yeah, I was going through your Twitter, and yeah, it's important. Obviously important to be well informed and you know, be a part of things like that. So thanks for bringing that up. That's awesome. Last question for you. Promise is the last one, and I'll stop holding you hostage here. I recently saw, I was scrolling through Instagram today, just kind of preparing for this interview, and I saw one of you had a picture. I think it was you on the field, and the quote that you had underneath the picture was, "Be where your feet are." Can you just talk, and I feel like it's a fitting way to end this podcast and some of the lessons and things that you've shared, especially tying back to mindfulness, kind of just share what that quote means to you and the importance of it.
Now you got me all worked up, so I'm gonna, like, probably make everything, like, super zen or whatever. But I mean, you touched on it, even saying that, like, with the mindfulness, like, that is probably, like, one of the most, like, mindful practices you can have, is, like, being where your feet are, is, like, being present in the moment, like, not worrying about what has happened before you and what's to come, is, like, what can you control now? And there's so many quotes about, like, that really specifically is, like, you know, life's 90% or 10% what happens to you, 90% how you react. Like, it's just one of those things, is, like, you just have to be active in your mind, because if you're, like, if you are too worried about the future or too worried about the past, like, you're not, I guess in a way you are, just what you are is who you are, but, like, can you really truly be yourself if you're too far in the future, if you're too far in the past? Like are you even really making your own decisions, or are you making decisions off because of shame that you're worried about in the past, or are you making decisions because of worries or concerns that you have about in the future? You're not you're not in the moment if you're thinking about the past or the future. So it's just, it's one of the, like, what are you being controlled by? How much can you control where you are? So, like, that's one of my wife's favorite quotes too. She has it like written, on a post-it note on her, desktop screen or whatever is her computer screen. Yeah, it's just a good reminder overall, especially in the moment that I'm in now. Free agent. I mean, it sucks, but like Jake's coming back to Michigan. He lives 20 minutes from me, where he grew up. And so just so happens that his college punter just got let go from the Bills yesterday, the same day. And so, you know, being where our feet are, that punter lives locally too. All of a sudden, you know, I've been snapping at a local gym to a net by myself. And I'm getting work in, but it's not the same kind of quality of work that I'm going to have when those both those guys are back in town and we actually have a full operation. Both of those guys are U of M grads. We're going to be able to go into their indoor facilities and get full operations in a turf field, in a climate-controlled environment with uprights, with everything we could possibly need. Like, it's such a good situation to be in. It sucks that we're all free agents, but, like, if we are where our feet are, if we are where our feet are, like, it's the best situation to be in as free agents. Not a lot of guys have a punter, kicker, and snapper, all NFL caliber. All those guys are awesome. Like, I've watched Brad punt before. I've obviously seen Jake kick a ton. Like, when he told me, like, it sucks, but like when he told me like Brad got cut too, I'm like, is he local? And he's like, yeah. I was like, yo, like, that is like a free agent cheat code, kind of. Like, we need to get work in. You know, I was taking like training this season like seriously. I was doing like twice a week. It was like a good balance between like my personal life, my business that I started, and like football. And it was working for me, and I'm still snapping at a high level, I feel like. But like now I'm like, that like kind of moved up in the ranks of importance to take advantage of that opportunity that we have. So it's like, it's all about where you are. How can you make the best of whether you feel like you're in a shitty situation? How can you like ground yourself and like just take advantage of every possible thing that's happening?
I mean, I love the quote, man. And I feel like the, what you just brought up as an example, I think is perfect. Like, it just illustrates the quote perfectly. It's like, yeah, you could sit and pout and be like, this sucks, you know, or you could look on the bright side and be like, well, you know, I have two, you know, NFL caliber guys coming to town and I can practice with them and stay sharp. And hopefully when another opportunity, you know, presents itself, I'm ready. So
that's one thing is like you mentioned, like I could look on the bright side, like truth be told, like your choices sometimes in life sometimes aren't going to be like, sometimes there isn't going to be a way to like look on the bright side of things, and you just have two options. Like sometimes you just have to be decisive. And I don't mean that to like say like you were wrong in that, because like sometimes there are like bright sides to like look at, but like sometimes you're just faced with decisions. And again, if you're being ruled by shame of the past or fear of the future, like you're going to pause and you're going to be paralysis by analysis and just not make a decision, when sometimes just making progress towards anything is better than just like sitting there. And I told Jake that I was like, you deserve time to like decompress a little bit, but like, remember, dude, like this is the first time, you know, my sage advice as a longtime free agent guy and guy who has NFL experience now is like, you deserve and need time to decompress on your own. Don't forget, it is the NFL season. Two kickers got picked up this week. Three kickers got picked up this week. A punter got, like, two punters got picked up this week too. Like, we are in the shit right now. You could be getting a call. You could be getting claimed on waivers by the time I talked to him last night. You know, by 4 p.m. he could have gotten claimed by waivers. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. So like, plan on all of these things being true, which again is hard on our mental, but like if you do get home and it's the weekend, like chill out for a little bit. Nobody's going to make transactions on a Saturday or Sunday. Take a day, chill out. But like this next week, if you're back by Monday, let's figure out our schedule and like get to it. So it's just like you have to keep moving no matter how slow you might move.
Well, I really like your point about making a decision. I just had Derek Sivers on the podcast, who is this entrepreneur, sold his company for like $20 million and now is living his best life in New Zealand. And he had this really great advice, especially in today's day and age where, I mean, information is so abundant. He said a lot of people don't have an issue getting information. They have an issue just not taking action on the information that they already have. And truth be told, in most scenarios, like, you actually have all the information that you need to get started and to actually get ahead. And he said it's kind of like when you're playing around with ChatGPT, and let's say you do like the the deep research feature where, you know, it thinks for like 8 minutes and it finally spits out an answer. It's like, imagine if you're doing that with ChatGPT, but every time it started working, you would give it another input. Or you would modify the question. Then it would have to restart.
But what about this?
Right.
Did you think about this? What if this
happened? It would just, yeah. Like, and it would just never get to an answer.
Yeah.
So he was like, stop rerunning the program. Like, run the program, let it run. And then once you have an answer or inklings of an answer, then you go back and then you modify the input and rerun it again. But don't interrupt it. Like, keep it running. So
There's the paralysis by analysis, which I like try to repeat to myself a lot, especially with starting my businesses, like my brick and mortar this off season. But also like, what was it? Just being decisive. And I think it's important. Like, one of my employees right now, I actually am about to talk to him after we get off this podcast, is like, he's on like, we just hired him like last month, and he's like on a 90-day development plan, like kind of like a probation thing. And he's going to get a little bit of a raise at the end of it. But we need to figure out, because we're so new as a store and we have so few employees, we need to figure out like what direction he's going to go in. Is he going to handle social media? Is he going to be in the back end packing orders? Is he going to handle stuff on our website? And we're like, I had a conversation with him. Where do you want to grow? And he's like, I really don't know. And I'm like, all right, like, if you can't tell me right now, I'll make the decision for you. You go, I'm going to send you on this. You do it for X amount of time. Then we're going to have a conversation and I'm going to say, do you like this enough to keep doing it? Or do you know that this is something that you're not interested in? Because at this point, if you don't know which way, which direction you're going to go, I'm going to start closing, not in a bad way, closing doors. Okay, cool. You don't want to do social media. That's fine. So now we have four options instead of five. Sometimes you just have to like do stuff to know that you don't like it. And that's kind of who I am as a person. Like, whether it's like an entrepreneurial thing, I'll research it. I'm like, oh, wait, I'm already bored within a week. This obviously isn't for me, because I know when I find like my things that I dig my claws in, there's nothing you can do to get me to stop doing it. But if I have five options laid out, I'm going to be like, oh, I need to do it. And then I'll know. So you need to like figure out what the answer isn't sometimes rather than what it is. And that's just by action. 100%. So yeah.
100%. Takeaway from this podcast, take action and stop seeking more information. You have all the information you need. Tabor, man, thank you so much for your time today. This has been an awesome conversation. Can't believe it's been an hour 42 already. Time has flown by. Wild. Real quick, before we sign off, where can people find you and more of your work?
Yep. All my social media is at Tabor Snapping, TayborSnapping, or Tabor's Napping, I guess. It works both ways. I learned that in college. And then also shout out to my trading card business. Ginza Marketplace is the name of like the storefront. And then our website is Ginza TCG. G-I-N-Z-A TCG as in trading card game.com, and then also Ginza MKT for marketplace. But check out cards. We got English, Japanese Pokemon, English, Japanese One Piece, Magic Gathering, Labubus, blind boxes, different stuff from Japan. So check that out. A little shameless self plug.
No, of course. Love it. We'll put all those links in the description. Dude, again, can't thank you enough for your time today. This has been awesome. And as a 49ers fan, this means a lot. So thanks again.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate it. It was a good podcast.
All right. Till next time.